Hello and welcome to episode 12 of Checking the Gate, a Film and Religion podcast. I am Robert Wright Stasko.
I am Michael M. Patty, and I am amazed that we have done almost a whole year's worth of these.
Yes, next month.
Next month will be the one-year anniversary of episode zero.
I think we might have some special outtakes and funny bits from the shows just to kind of celebrate.
I can guarantee we will not be giving away prizes.
Someone needs to give us a prize.
Yes.
But I actually should get the prize for epic fail, because as we were planning out the episodes, Mike pointed out to me that this episode is coming out just before Easter.
So I thought it would be a good idea if we had ourselves an Easteravaganza.
Yes, and me being a worship leader, I should have been on top of that the whole time. So kudos to Mike. Epic fail for me.
Least I could do.
All right, so today we're going to be talking, instead of what we planned before, we're going to be talking about Martin Scorsese's excellent film, The Last Temptation of Christ, and also Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ. And in TV Corner, keeping with the theme of resurrection, we're going to be talking about the recently wrapped up second season of The Walking Dead.
Only because we couldn't think of any other TV show that would fit into the theme. Jesus isn't a main character on very many shows.
Yeah.
It was either The Walking Dead or Highlander, and which one just got 9 million viewers and is still on the air, and which one is not even in reruns anymore.
I know, you really liked Highlander.
Yes, but upon rewatching it recently when it was still on Netflix streaming, I kept promising my wife that it got better. We made it into season 4, and we just couldn't bring ourselves to watch the Evil Duncan episodes. We had to stop. And then they took it down, and I don't think either one of us misses it. Which is a shame, because it did get better in season 5. And then stunningly, stunningly worse in season 6. But that's neither here nor there. We're not talking about this episode, so.
Yeah, I quit watching it about season 2.
Watch season 5.
So first we're going to discuss Scorsese's forgotten masterpiece, The Last Temptation of Christ. So this one, I really feel The Last Temptation is wrongly accused of blasphemy.
To give a little background, when it first came out, there was a lot of uproar from the Christian community, I remember. And I was just a kid when it came out, and I remember hearing people being upset with it because it differs from the Gospels. Jesus gets married and has a family. That's all I knew about it for years until I first saw it. I think Robert let me borrow it, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
And
I got it from Blockbuster, who banned it when it first came out on video.
Of course they did.
But then when it came out on DVD, I remember renting it from the store I worked at. So, there you go.
And the whole point of the movie, in a too-brief-to-do-it-justice summary, is that it says right at the outset, this movie is not based on the Gospels. What the film is about is the life of Jesus realizing he's the Messiah and that he has to spread God's word and die for people's sins. The first 2 hours of the movie is getting to know Jesus, seeing his miracles, and being one of his followers as the viewer. Then at the 2 hour mark, he's crucified, and a little girl who says she's his guardian angel comes up to him and says, "You don't have to die. God forgives you. Come on down. Live the rest of your life as a mortal. It's okay." And we see what happens when he falls in love with Mary Magdalene and then another woman. After Mary Magdalene dies, we see him raise a family and on his natural deathbed. And he realizes, after Judas in his vision comes and explains to him that it's in fact not real. I forgot to mention the little girl is Satan. And then he decides, you know what? I do still need to die for people's sins. He goes out and tells God that he is ready to be the Messiah. And then he's back on the cross and says it's accomplished, and ends up dying for people's sins. I couldn't help but think, I did rewatch it before we record this, that everybody who thought it was controversial didn't see the movie, because it came across to me as the most Christian movie I've ever seen. Even me, who's not a staunch believer in Christianity, I thought this was a remarkable film because of the setup and the payoff and the characterization and the drama. It's fantastic. And anybody who thinks it's sacrilegious is missing the point.
Right. From the outset, like you said, it didn't ever claim to be a depiction of the Gospels. It's based on a book by Nikos Kazantzakis. Forgive me if I mispronounced that. But it's based on a work of fiction. And I think that from what I know of historical research, he must have looked at Albert Schweitzer's work. Albert Schweitzer was a doctor, theologian, organist who lived around the turn of the century. And he founded a hospital in Africa. And if you want to learn more about that, you can watch an episode of the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, which talks all about that. But his theological work was very interesting because during his time, people did not believe that Jesus was an actual historical figure. And his slant on Jesus was try to prove that he was. And looking at the life of Jesus in the Gospels, he gave his own interpretation. And it goes something like this. This is from Craig Blomberg's book, Jesus and the Gospels. Schweitzer's Jesus was consistently eschatological, which means he's concerned about the end of the world. An apocalyptic Jew who became convinced God would supernaturally intervene to establish his kingdom on earth during his lifetime. Jesus sent out the 12 disciples with his expectation, only to have it frustrated. The second stage in his ministry thus followed as Jesus became convinced that he had to take upon himself the tribulations or messianic woes that many Jews believe had to precede the coming of the new age. This would be accomplished by his death, so he went to Jerusalem as a hidden Messiah, convinced he must become a martyr. Peter and Judas, each in their own ways, disclosed Jesus' messianic claims to the authorities so that he was crucified. That the kingdom did not immediately appear as he had envisioned implies that, in one sense, he died a failure. And this is kind of what comes through in the movie when they talk about Jesus kind of shifting gears, changing the focus of his ministry. You see this when he has the vision of taking the axe. There's a definite shift in the movie as to the kinds of things that Jesus is saying in this movie. And also the more realistic look at Jesus, the human side of him, like trying to psychologically come to terms with his divine nature. It almost drives him crazy in this movie.
Yeah.
In this movie, he's not entirely sure of the content of his visions, and they are as confusing to him as they are to the audience at times.
I was struck from a technical standpoint. Martin Scorsese directed it, and it is very much a Jesus movie directed by Martin Scorsese. It is gritty and very realistic. There's nudity. There's the crucifixion details are spot on, historically accurate, how they pierced the wrist and not the palm. We'll more on that later. Yeah. And the way the legs were angled.
I like the fact that this is part of what was so controversial, is they show Jesus naked on the cross and depicts just the humiliation he went through to be crucified. That's, I think, a more accurate portrayal of the crucifixion than in the next movie we're going to look at.
Yeah.
But this movie had, because of that and some of the other images like Jesus reaching into his chest and pulling out his heart, these sort of things were very controversial, especially to the fundamentalists.
Which surprises me because there's that famous painting of Jesus holding his heart.
Right.
Which I thought that was what that was supposed to be reminiscent of.
Yeah, but if you come from a Catholic background, that's a familiar image. If you're from like a fundamentalist background, that's not an image you see every day.
I was not aware of that.
Yeah, evangelicals tend to shun the Catholic imagery, statues and pictures, Stations of the Cross. You don't find that in a lot of churches.
Oh.
That comes from the Calvinist movement, was like four walls and a sermon. That's all you need in the church.
That surprises me that so many fundamentalists embraced the Passion. And I don't know if I'm jumping ahead here, but it seemed to me like a lot of the imagery in the Passion was designed to invoke a lot of the European art of a couple centuries ago.
Right.
And I'll once we shift gears, I'll talk about that, some of the things I noticed, and maybe Robert noticed some more. But that surprises me that that one would have upset people. I am from a Catholic background, so I am familiar with the image of Jesus holding the heart with, what is it, thorn, or the ring of thorns?
Yeah, that's his crown of thorns. He's holding the heart. The heart's on fire in some, yeah. some pictures. Yeah, there's a Bible verse I think could defend like the added images and imagery and the things in this movie. John 21, verse 25, the very last book of the very last gospel. It says, "Now there are also many other things that Jesus did. Were every one of them to be written, I suppose that the world itself could not contain the books that would be written." So there's so much that Jesus did that isn't in the Bible. Reduce it down to just what's in the Bible, which is what a lot of evangelicals want to do. It's a dangerous thing.
And it doesn't make for good filmmaking either.
Right, right. Yeah, we're going to talk about that in a little bit.
Yes, we are.
But this movie I watched after I was reading the book by Paul Flesher and Robert Torrey called Film and Religion. And they went through a bunch of these Jesus movies, like Jesus Christ Superstar.
Which I thought we were going to talk about also, but I had neither the time nor inclination. I've seen it, and it's not worth scholarly discussion.
Right, because these movies show, they show very sort of weak images of Christ. You know, he's reactionary, he doesn't take charge, or he doesn't do any miracles, he's just sort of there. But then you watch this movie, The Last Temptation of Christ, and you see Jesus doing miracles, healing lepers, you know, doing this amazing things, doing all these miraculous things, even though they're not, you know, scripturally accurate. It's showing Jesus displaying his divine power, which a lot of movies about Jesus do not do.
It's true to the character.
Right.
You know, it's like how Spider-Man had organic web shooters in the movie. It's true to the character. He still shoots webs. He just didn't invent a brand new mechanism to shoot artificial web fluid that he also invented himself.
And one other thing I like about this movie, I love the score. Peter Gabriel's excellent music in this movie. It's just so moving.
Most of it's good. I thought there were a couple times when it screamed 80s pop star. Most of it was good and suited the movie.
Yeah, his soundtrack for The Long Walk Home does better. It's not as dated as this one, but he did do a lot of research into like ancient instruments of the region to try and pull out the authenticity that Scorsese was doing with trying to create an accurate looking Jerusalem.
I kept hoping Sledgehammer would play over the closing credits, but it did not.
No, that was big time. And my heaven will be a big heaven, and I will walk through the big doors. That's how we roll here.
All right.
The next movie we're going to look at, Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ, he tried to do the same thing Scorsese did by making it
ultra-realistic and gritty and in-your-face. And
but he did it in a different way. He did it in a more Hollywood way, I think, didn't quite work.
If I can make a Peter Gabriel reference, it came across a little sledgehammery.
Yeah.
And just the obvious, you know, Satan lurking in the background. Satan's in Last Temptation, but he was a little more... In Last Temptation, Satan was a pillar of fire or a little girl. He was cleverly disguised. In this one, Satan is a creepy-looking guy. It's a little obvious.
Yeah, he looks like that creepy-looking guy in the Da Vinci Code.
Yes, he does. You're right. Who was that, Paul Bettany?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, The Passion, even though this movie claims to be very realistic, they speak in Aramaic and Latin, and I think there's a little bit of Hebrew in there.
Yeah, that's the key word. It claims to be authentic and realistic, and it tries to be, but...
It's based less on the Gospels and more on the Dolorous Passion of our Lord Jesus Christ, which, according to the Criterion website for The Last Temptation of Christ, is an account of the ravings of the anti-Semitic nun Anne Catherine Emmerich. Gibson did say that he looked to these writings for his inspiration there. So there's things that are added in there, like the 20-minute scene where Jesus is whipped to the inch of his life.
Yeah.
That's one of the few miraculous things he does in this movie. He takes a beating beyond human tolerance there.
From a technical film standpoint, the scene goes on far too long.
Yes, it does. Especially because it's based on this one verse from Matthew 27, verse 26. It says, "Then Pilate released for them, the Jews, Barabbas, and having scourged Jesus, delivered him to be crucified." Okay, those four words, "and having scourged Jesus," was turned into a 20-minute
yeah.
a horror scene. It's really a scene from a horror movie. And according to this website from the Methodist Church, the film was said to have moved Billy Graham to tears and Pope John Paul II to remark, "It is as it was," which is surprising to me.
Like I said before, I'm surprised that this was so well embraced because it seems like it was sloppily made. All of my complaints about it are technical with the narrative and with the filmmaking decisions that were made. I definitely don't think we got the same kind of narrative setup and payoff that we did with Last Temptation. It starts out in the Garden of Gethsemane,
right,
when Jesus is about to be arrested. And then we, you know, he's arrested and they all that. And
it basically takes over the period of about 2 days.
Right. We see flashbacks of him talking with his mother and building a table and being a carpenter and the Last Supper. We see bits and pieces. But the truth is, if I didn't know the story, if I hadn't read the book already, I'd have been completely lost. And going back to what I was just saying a minute ago about it trying to be realistic, again, I'm going to compare it to The Last Temptation because I did just see that and just see The Passion. In The Passion of the Christ, there was more of an effort to appeal to what people thought the crucifixion looked like in casting Jim Caviezel, who is as white and American as they come.
Right.
A lot of the other cast, Peter and John and Judas, looked Middle Eastern, and that's good. The guy who played Pilate, I thought, was really charismatic. He looked good for a Roman. I liked him. Not David Bowie, but, you know, who is?
I love David Bowie.
He's only in one scene, and he's awesome.
Yeah.
But Jim Caviezel still looks like what Renaissance painters thought Jesus looked like, rather than what a Middle Eastern named Yeshua looked like. The crucifixion was done through the palms and through the feet, which is not historically accurate. The Last Temptation is how it was really done. I've seen specials.
Yeah, through the wrists.
There was a 2 minute restaging of the Pietà as he was taken down from the cross. Stuff like that. That he went through all the trouble to have it in the original languages, but still does stuff like that. It's a cop-out.
Yeah, and the stuff he throws in is more from like Catholic legend than it is from gospel truth. Like the lady who runs up and pats his face dry, and that's like a relic in the Catholic. It's like an image of Jesus' face on this cloth.
I'm glad they didn't show that. That would have been over.
No, that's
the top.
In there. That's in there.
I saw her wiping it, but they didn't show his face on the cloth.
Oh, yeah. But they do have like the Shroud of Turin there
which doesn't make sense because the Shroud of Turin is supposed to be
supposed to be his burial cloth.
Yeah, and he ascended into heaven, but he was resurrected. So
and if you're not a Christian, like you said, if you haven't read the book, you get to that last scene and you're like, what's going on?
Right.
What I don't get it. I just saw him die.
It doesn't mention that was the third day rebuilding the temple, which is really harped upon in Last Temptation.
Right.
You don't know what's going on or why he's there, just that all of a sudden Jesus is back to life. Another technical complaint I had with the movie was the egregious amount of slow motion that was used. When he's arrested, there's like the guy getting his ear cut off is in slow motion. When he's carrying the cross, every time he falls, there's slow motion. When he's being scourged, it's in slow motion. It's overdone, and it's a joke.
That's Hollywood shorthand for being artistic.
Yeah, it's a joke.
Yeah, where Scorsese, he's artistic in the way that he frames a shot and puts the content in the shot. The image you're looking at is artistically done. It's well lit, well acted. Mel Gibson, he's going for a gut reaction.
Yeah. It's sledgehammery. That really is the right word.
Yeah. I mean, literally, his hand is holding the sledgehammer that pounds the nails into Jesus' hand.
I knew that. Yeah. Thank you for bringing that back.
But that's what he's going for. He wants to make it personal and guttural, and really he wants to hit you with that sledgehammer.
Yeah.
He's
not appealing to the brain. He's trying to appeal to your emotions. He's literally preaching to the choir. I think the only people who get that sort of reaction are the ones who go to see it to be moved.
Right.
Let's not forget the single drop of rain that falls and shakes the earth as he dies. It's terrible CG. It's over the top.
Yeah. But if we think it should have done better, because
they should have done better.
It says
this man has an Academy Award for direction.
Right, and it says in IMDb they made this for $30 million. Some of it was his own money. I remember reading about him really trying to get it financed and distributed because it was his passion project. But it did make $370 million.
Wow.
Compared to The Last Temptation, which Scorsese made, this is in the 80s, but for a budget of about $7 million. Okay, and he did so much more with that $7 million, and it only made about $8 million domestically.
Wow.
It did better overseas, but it probably just barely made its money back. I don't know how much they promoted it, because I know it got a lot of free promotion with all the protests and stuff going on, but still not a ton of people went to see this movie in the theater.
If you want to get free publicity as a filmmaker, make a religious movie.
Yeah. But
let me rephrase that. Make a Jesus movie. If you want to get yourself heard of as a filmmaker, make a Jesus movie. Yeah. People will protest you.
Yeah, Kevin Smith did that with Dogma, and I heard he went and protested the movie himself to promote it. If you look at the reviews for this movie and how it was received critically, so we looked at how it was received in the mass population.
One of my friends who is a devout Christian, and he posts religious song lyrics and Bible verses and stuff relating to, Lord, I need your strength today, all the time on Facebook. I remember after this first came out, he recommended it to me, and I never saw it until this very day, literally.
Oh, The Passion?
Yeah.
Yeah, that one, if you look on Rotten Tomatoes, the way it was received, 49%.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, so it's not a critical hit. If you look at the reviews for Last Temptation of Christ, 83% positive reviews, which is really good.
Yeah.
And you think how long it's been out.
I'd like to state for the record, I did not hate The Passion of the Christ. I thought the costuming was really good. I thought it was good that they went to the effort to do the original languages. Everybody must have, worked hard to do it phonetically, I'm sure, but to get that down, and it seemed that was flawless as far as I could tell. Everybody seemed like they knew what they were saying. Again, my biggest complaints were all technical and narrative. And there's one more big one to come that we haven't touched on, and we'll get to that in a minute.
I think it's just the way this film was received and the way it was, depicted as accurate. I think it struck a chord with the people who saw it.
Yeah.
Like there's the case in Texas. A teenager had killed his pregnant girlfriend, and after seeing the movie, confessed to the murder.
I remember that. I remember hearing about that.
There were things like that that happened. But this movie, since it came out, it's been sort of tainted by the director's own...
Which, admittedly, he was drunk when he said it, but still said it. It still came out of his mouth.
Right. When the movie came out, it was decried as anti-Semitic because of the way it's depicted.
Not on a huge scale, but it was it was said.
So these accusations were hurled at the movie when it came out. But a lot of theologians would tell you, when you look at what happened, and you can't support anti-Semitism in the Bible, because this is really an internal family feud. Jesus was a Jew and the other Jews were disagreeing with him, and that's what the whole conflict is.
In the film, it's clear that the one Pharisee, Caiaphas, is the one who is really rallying for Jesus to be crucified because he's the head of a religious sect and sees Jesus as a blasphemer. I don't think you can take that as an incrimination of the entire Jewish race. If anything, it's the exact opposite. He is completely a one-note villain in the movie. That was my other big complaint. And it's not anti-Semitic because this poorly written character is the villain of the piece. Jesus was Jewish, and in the movie, not every Jew in the picture wants him killed.
Right. there are some other Pharisees who are depicted accurately from Scripture as jumping up and defending Jesus.
Yes.
I mean, he was causing dissension within the ranks there.
Yeah. So if I can paraphrase Larry Flint, all Mel Gibson is guilty of is poor screenwriting.
And also, in this incident that happened a few years after the movie was made,
yeah,
he was
but
drunk.
then that happened, and you had to reconsider.
Right, he was drunk, and he was being escorted out, and called the officer was arresting him
some bad names. Yeah. So, kids, don't drink and drive, and don't hate Jews. Don't be Mel Gibson.
Yeah, when Mel Gibson apologized for this, the Anti-Defamation League said, quote, Mel Gibson's apology is unremorseful and insufficient. It's not a proper apology. They go on to say his tirade finally reveals his true self and shows that his protestations during the debate over his film, The Passion of the Christ, that he is such a tolerant, loving person were a sham. It may well be that the bigotry has been passed from father to son.
Yeah, Mel's father is supposedly a big anti-Semite. I am no longer a Mel Gibson fan because of his ravings, drunk or not.
Also, what happened between him and his ex-wife.
Oh,
That was public and very nasty.
Yeah, it turns out he's kind of slimy.
But
I'm not sure that charge can be... Having seen the film for the first time today, I'm not sure that was... And I was trying to look for it critically, and I'm not sure you can level that against it.
I try to divorce the actions of a person from their work. I'm unsuccessful, you know, especially when it comes to directors like Roman Polanski.
Yeah, I won't watch a Roman Polanski film.
You know, same thing with Gibson. I try to watch this movie. Like, the first time I watched it, I was moved to tears. But
really?
I
laughed a couple times, honestly.
Yeah, but you aren't watching it from a mindset of... This is my Lord and my Savior.
Okay.
Getting the life whipped out of him.
Yeah. I was moved when I watched Last Temptation last week. I forgot how powerful it was. It's incredible.
Yeah. And I had the same reaction, too. Even though they're inventing the sort of lapsed temptation, it allowed me to identify with Jesus and, like, you know what? Maybe all my sins are crucified on that cross with him. Watching this movie is just... I can't divorce for what Gibson has done since making that movie. And so it didn't have that great as impact as it did when I first watched it. To me, it was like, this guy, you know, the lousy drunk, you know, he's... But I guess that just proves that everyone needs Jesus, especially Mel Gibson. Is his sins greater than mine? I can't say.
Yes. Yes, they are. Okay, that was good discussion. Let's move on to TV Corner.
All right, so we're going to talk right now about The Walking Dead.
Yes.
Keeping with the resurrection theme.
Yes. I know that's a little tacky, but it's popular. We both like it.
Well, there are zombies in the Bible.
And I can think of one. I can think of two. Yeah.
Jesus is not a zombie. How many times do I have to tell you?
I'd like to take this opportunity to apologize to anyone that I have now offended twice by claiming Jesus was a zombie. I really don't mean it in anything more than a hearty jest, or else I wouldn't be co-hosting a film and religion podcast.
Yeah, stop watching Futurama. Well, here's where there are zombies in the Bible.
Okay.
Matthew 27. This was, if you remember, the scene in Passion where the earth starts shaking and there's an earthquake in the temple and it rips the curtain in two.
Yes, that was one of the times I laughed.
Yeah, that effect wasn't well done. It's been portrayed better in other movies, but here's the scripture. Matthew 27, verse 51 through 53. And behold, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom, and the earth shook and the rocks were split. The tombs also were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many. So there you go. It doesn't describe, like, what condition they were in, if they were...
And lo, the villagers took it upon themselves to smite them with rocks to the head.
That's Mike's addition to the Bible. But yeah, so...
I'm like River Tam, I'm fixing it.
Yeah, I've recently become enamored with The Walking Dead.
Have you seen all of them? Have you caught up?
Yes. Okay. So, spoilers for everyone. We're going to be talking through the recently shown
finish
finale
season two,
of
and
season
then
two.
And then come back. But as we've said before, you should be watching it already.
Yeah, because it's great storytelling. Even if you're put off by the horror and violence, it's not all that bad.
It's yes, there's some of that in every episode, but there is also plenty of drama and suspense and tension.
Yeah, like the show, The Game of Thrones, it's a soap opera for nerds.
Indeed. Robert, I have to ask you this.
Yeah.
Team Rick or Team Shane?
Team Rick all the way.
Team Rick all the way. Agreed.
Team Rick. But I certainly identified with Shane. I really felt bad for him sometimes.
I did not. I never did. And I think some of it has to do, you know, it's for dramatic effect. He's the foil. Andrea said in one episode that, you know, try a lighter touch. You know, you have everybody's best interests at heart. But his solution to every problem was, let's just kill him. Literally, every problem was solved with the gun, rather than trying to work for a solution.
Well, that was only part of his problem. The other part of his problem was Lori, because this stupid woman wanted to have her cake and eat it too. Because when her husband came back, she shoved him away, but then would say little things here and there to kind of keep him around, because she knew that he was gonna. She wanted. The safety that he provided, but also her cuddly husband. So she wanted Shane to do all the dirty work so Rick wouldn't have to be that way.
And when did Rick ever let anybody down? You know, that's what I keep coming back to.
Right.
What did Rick do that endangered anybody? He went back for Sophia and she ran off.
Yeah.
Aren't we supposed to be talking about religion?
Yeah, we'll get to that.
Okay.
But that's the thing is... You have Herschel as a religious character.
Yeah.
And he's trying to do the right thing. And same thing with Rick. He's trying to do the right thing. Where Shane has sort of thrown out all the sort of morals and ethics of the previous
it's like,
life.
Woohoo. It's, you know, free beer and killing now. And I can do whatever I want and there's no ramifications. Let's just do things the easy way and it'll be safe.
Right. He's just worried about survival.
Yeah. I'm sorry I slipped into a southern accent there. The character is from Georgia.
Yeah, he's just worried about survival.
Yeah.
Or Rick is trying to salvage
civilization.
He's trying to salvage life. And that's what Lori wants. And once Shane is out of the picture, once Rick kills Shane, he then becomes Shane.
I disagree. I think that has yet to be seen.
I think we've seen it a little bit. You know, he's like, this is no longer democracy.
Yeah, it's a Ricktatorship.
Yes.
I'm looking forward to seeing what they do with that in season three, because I hope his character doesn't change so radically, because one of the things I've liked through the two seasons is knowing that however precarious the situation got, you know, were they going to kill the hostage who knew where the farm was? Or were they going to give up the search for the little girl? I knew that Rick was going to do the right thing, and I took comfort in that watching it. I like seeing Rick. He's my favorite character. And I liked knowing that he was the good guy.
But another character who really tries to do the right thing is Herschel.
Yes, you know, I'm glad they kept him alive.
Right, he was keeping walkers in the barn because he didn't know as much as the Grimes gang did about why people were turning into zombies and what the process was and if they could be cured or not. He was trying to do the Christian thing, was, you know, keep them alive, keep them comfortable.
And see if he could save them later on.
Right, right. He was trying to, maybe he had a little bit of a Messiah complex himself, you know, trying to, you know, run the show, do the right thing. But he had a very interesting line in the very last show. He said, "Jesus said there's going to be a resurrection of the dead. I just didn't think it would be like this."
Yeah.
It asks a question that I've said this before, that all good science fiction does. What if this really happened? How would people of faith really react?
Yeah, I think the portrayal of that, I think since it does take place in Georgia, which is predominantly Christian, I think that aspect is given the short shrift. It doesn't really come up as much as I think it would with Southerners.
Yeah.
There was one scene in a church, and I'm going to try and do my Rick impression. Of course, the main character starts off his prayer with, sits down, looks up at the crucifix. "Lord, I'm not usually a praying man, but if you could see fit to help that little girl find her home, I'd be eternally grateful," or something to that effect. I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah, but you notice
my best British actor doing Southern accent impression.
Yeah, but that was a disturbing scene, to walk in the church and there's people sitting there in their Sunday best, zombified.
Zombies. Yeah.
And that crucifix, which I don't think you'd see in a Southern Baptist church.
You don't think?
No.
I don't know. It's in a Catholic church.
Right. You don't see crucifixes in Protestant churches.
Oh, okay. That's news to me.
Yeah.
Okay. So I really think they're in real life. There would be more of praying and trying to figure out what rising from the dead meant spiritually, if that meant they didn't get to heaven. I think it should be discussed. But it's a drama, and it's not a philosophy show.
They touch on the philosophy a little bit, but
a little bit.
They don't have time because they're either A, running from zombies, or B,
running from zombies.
Yeah, I was quite disappointed with the first half of the second season because there's
a lot of people. There was one episode in particular that was just dreadful.
It was
the one where
so
they're
slow.
Pulling the zombie out of the well. Was terrible.
Yeah, there's just like nothing happening.
Yeah.
You know, that was just like a gross shock factor, but that was it.
The
second half, they got things going, and the last three episodes were all dynamite.
Yeah.
On the show following the Talking Dead, they said the third season's going to be more action-y, so...
They're bringing in more elements from the comic book. I'm not a reader of the comic book, so I'm not sure how well that will translate to a character drama, but they've been doing well so far, so I'm willing to give it a chance. Yeah. And supposedly Merle's coming back. There is a rumor that the guys that Randall turned out to be with, that's where Merle's been this whole time, supposedly.
I don't think that's a surprise. As soon as you have like a really big actor, like the guy, well, not a big actor, but you know, a pretty well-known, recognizable actor, leave in your first show. And, you know, sort of
he was in a couple of them. He was in two or
he was in a flashback.
Them,
yeah.
But he was in one in the second season. That's right.
Yeah, he was like in flashback form. But yeah, we're going to see him again.
Oh, yeah.
The way they set it up, you know, we're definitely going to see him again.
Yeah, he said so at a con.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, the rumor is that's how he returns. He's been holed up with these guys that Randall, the prisoner they were holding, kept denying. He confessed to Shane. So now none of the survivors know that those guys are actually there.
Yeah.
Oh, I also thought of something else that was funny. What are the odds that prison in the season finale is going to be full of shoplifters and tax evaders and not rapists and murderers? Probably zero. Probably no chance of that.
So, yeah, we'll see. I haven't read the comic either, so I'm going to be pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, shoplifters and tax evaders. You know, minimum security, I'm sure.
Not the way that prison looked.
No. No.
So, looking forward to that.
Definitely.
All right. So, Mike, final thoughts on The Last Temptation?
It's fantastic. Worth all of the praise it's gotten. Brand new Blu-ray and DVD edition coming soon from Criterion. Probably won't pick it up because those are a little pricey. Excellent film. Go watch it if you haven't already. But again, why are you listening to this if you haven't?
Go out and buy the soundtrack by Peter Gabriel. It's called Passion. And speaking of Passion, final thoughts on Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ.
I'm sure it was a sincere film from Mel Gibson, that he made it exactly how he wanted to make it and the way he wanted to make it. I can't see past all of its technical and narrative flaws. I know I keep saying that, but that's how I felt about it. I can't imagine myself watching it again. It's not the better of the two.
Yeah, I agree with you and the critical voices. I like Last Temptation of Christ better because it shows Jesus doing miracles. He shows that he's concerned for people. The only miracle that Jesus does in Passion is endure. That's all he does. And he dies at a moment of his own choosing. That's all that happens in Passion. That's the only sort of divinity he exerts. There's also that one line that still moves me when just before he reaches Golgotha, his mother comes up to him and he says, "Look, mother, see, I make all things new." That gets me every time. But I get that feeling the whole time I'm watching The Last Temptation of Christ. Is that Christ is doing something, Jesus is doing something for all humanity and not just, you know, taking a beating. Final thoughts on Walking Dead.
Fantastic. Go out and buy season one and catch up on season two on demand if it's still there. AMC shows reruns all the time. Can't wait for season three. Good stuff.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I'm glad they killed Shane. I'm interested to see if Rick takes on some of Shane's characteristics.
I think he's going to persevere and stay true to himself. I think that's going to be they're introducing a new villain, and I think Rick's wanting to be more like Shane is going to be tested. But ultimately, since it's a TV show, I have a feeling he's going to stay true to himself.
Yeah. Well, since Dale was killed, and in the comic books, he's supposed to live longer and be sort of the moral voice.
Yeah, I think that's why they kept Herschel, to be the new curmudgeon.
Right. He's going to be the one to kind of pull Rick back and say, hey, yeah, I think you need to think about this. So that'll be interesting.
Yes, it will.
All right. Well, until next time, you could go to our website at www.ctgpodcast.com and download all of our old episodes. You can contact us, like we said before, on the Facebook at Checking the Gate Podcast. Send us an email at ctgpodcast@yahoo.com. Or you could send us a tweet at twitter.com/ctgpodcast. For our first anniversary episode, we're going to lighten the mood a little bit. We'll have some flashbacks to our bloopers that didn't make the final cut from before.
A lot of them involving us laughing.
Yeah.
The Dune episode in particular.
We went a little nuts on the grape soda there. And Mike, pick out the movies to avoid any other of my, you know, epic fails. So we're going to keep it light. We're going to do The Ten, starring Paul Rudd, which is about the Ten Commandments, sort of.
It's sort of about the Ten Commandments.
And we're going to look at the Simpsons and some of the religious commentary they make. And also, you know, there's been a lot written about the Simpsons.
Oh, God, yes.
And how people react to the religion that's portrayed in the show. So
yeah,
we'll be looking at that for next time. So,
and I promise to do my Reverend Lovejoy.
Constancy. Sweet Constancy.
That's right, boy. Do your dirty, sinful business.
All right, we'll save the rest for next show. And until next time, I'm Robert Wright Staska saying keep the faith.
And this is Michael M. Patty saying peace out.